It's taken almost 200,000 years for humans to evolve from cave-dwelling stone-throwers to net-surfing Twitterers. Is that evolution or devolution? Anyway, along the way were a few eureka moments when somebody figured out how to make life a little easier. Scientists in South Africa believe they've discovered evidence of just such a moment, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
So it's the southern tip of Africa, about 70,000 years ago, and some humans have built a fire. Maybe it's to keep warm or to cook up some gazelle steaks. To kill time, they do a little flint napping, whacking one rock with another to chip off razor-sharp flakes. They use the flakes to cut meat or make spear points. After the fire dies down, one of them drags a big stone out of the embers and tries whacking that, and discovers that it makes really good flakes. It chips predictably, and the flakes are symmetrical and sharp. Eureka! Pyroengineering is born.
It's a real critical step in the evolution of technology. Somewhere around 70,000 years ago, it became very common.
Kyle Brown is a graduate student in archaeology at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, and he makes his own stone tools. The campfire scenario is based on Brown's own eureka moment. Here's how it happened. Brown had noticed that many ancient tools found in South Africa were made from silcrete, a kind of rock notoriously difficult to work with. It's known that heating rock can improve stone for making tools, but no one knew when or where the practice started. So Brown tried heating some silcrete himself for 10 hours at a time.
I did a lot of the early experiments with a fire pit in my yard, just sitting up, making sure that the fire stayed hot and had enough wood on it.
What'd your neighbors think of you sitting out there all night long cooking rocks?
They think I'm pretty crazy.
Crazy or not, Brown discovered that the cooked rock was much easier to flake.
The stone becomes harder and stiffer. It basically becomes more brittle.
The flakes were sharper, too, and they had a certain glossiness on the surface that the 70,000-year-old stone tools also had. Writing in the journal Science, Brown says the practice must have been intentional. The flakes weren't made first and then dropped into a fire. He tried that, and it didn't work. Further tests suggested that cooking the rock first to about 600 degrees Fahrenheit apparently alters its crystalline structure and gives it something nappers call rebound hardness, so it fractures more predictably. Anthropologist Grant McCall from Tulane University, who studies and makes stone tools himself, says it seems to be part of the flowering of what scientists call behavioral modernity, things that modern humans did that set them apart from their ancestors.
The striking ones from elsewhere in southern Africa have to do with the manufacture of symbolic objects. So you have the manufacture of marine shell beads and engraved ochre fragments and things like that that indicate that people were operating in a very symbolic way.
This explosion of modern behavior, including pyroengineering tools, seems to have occurred earlier in South Africa than in Europe or Asia. And it's possible pyroengineering began even further back. The scientific team has found the same kind of tools at other South African sites that appear to date back 165,000 years. That's long before so-called modern behavior emerged elsewhere, making the discovery even more striking. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
The world could lose all of its coral reefs within our children's lifetimes. As the Earth heats up, warming ocean waters could be deadly. The fate of coral reefs will depend in part on how healthy they are to begin with. For the second story in our series, Oceans at Risk, NPR's Richard Harris travels to an island where scientists are trying to help coral reefs become more resilient.
Coral reefs are the rainforests of the oceans, teeming with diverse and postcard-perfect fish, towering sponges, and multicolored coral. The magnificent ecosystem along the shores of the Caribbean island of Bonaire is also a vital human resource. Think scuba tanks.
I think it's fair to say that's the sound of the economy of Bonaire, wouldn't you
yeah,
say?
Yeah, definitely. You hear this noise all day long, all around Bonaire.
Ramon de Leon is in charge of Bonaire's National Marine Park. It's one of the healthiest coral reefs in the Caribbean, and it's his job to keep it that way.
Bonaire is known as a diver's paradise. Anywhere between 50 and 70% of the economy is running in tourism, and 90% of the tourists is diving tourists.
On this balmy evening, de Leon has come to this combination bar and dive shop to meet up with a team of scientists. They plan to spend the next 10 days in the water to to see how the reef is doing.
Hi, are you Henry?
Yeah.
Hi, Gabriel.
Nice to meet you, Gabriel. Yeah.
Gabriel Grimsditch from the conservation group IUCN has organized the research. Their mission is to identify the factors that can keep this reef healthy and resilient. These scientists can't stop global warming from overheating the surrounding ocean waters, but they can identify other problems that make the coral more vulnerable to heat damage.
Okay, so where should we start? Maybe we can go through the methods?
Grimsditch explains that this is part of a project that's taking place around the globe. It was stimulated by a massive ocean warming episode 11 years ago. Overheated waters worldwide forced the colorful microorganisms that live inside the coral to abandon their homes. The coral turned white, it bleached, and a staggering 16% of all the world's coral died off during that episode.
And it basically got people thinking that climate change was actually one of the most important threats to corals at the moment. So people started looking at why coral reefs recover from bleaching or why they don't.
That's one reason they've come to Bonaire. The reef here was hit hard during the 1998 bleaching episode. Marine biologist Mark Vermey from the nearby island of Curaçao remembers it vividly.
The reef slope actually looked like a mountain slope full of snow. People here were taking their skis out and took pictures for home, like they were skiing the coral reefs.
But much to everybody's relief, the coral here didn't die off. The living microorganisms eventually returned to the mineral coral skeletons. The reef regained its color and came back to life. But Bonaire's reefs may not stay healthy enough to bounce back next time. Some parts of the reef are under pressure from the very people who come to admire them. The next day, the biologists take their first dive. It's right off one of the many resorts on Bonaire. Ramon de Leon squeezes into his wetsuit and straps on a 35-pound tank.
How do I look?
You look glorious.
Girl, that's the whole I count. Bom, vámonos.
Clipboard in one hand, measuring square in the other, De Leon trudges across a small beach of imported sand and leads his colleagues into the water. This resort looks idyllic. The sand, palm trees, a tiki hut bar. But as Mark Vermey emerges from the dive an hour later, he says the reef offshore looks bad.
Now, this is not something you get happy about, that's for sure.
Sure, he saw a lot of corals out there.
But instead of pointing up, they're pointing sideways right now.
It turns out this reef was whacked by a tropical storm last October. That in itself shouldn't be such a big deal. Reefs have been clobbered by storms for millions of years and recovered. But Vermey says the added stress of living alongside human beings made it hard for this reef to bounce back. For one thing, nutrient runoff from the resort's lush gardens have encouraged green algae to smother the coral in places.
You can sort of see what happens, right? You hit them once, and then everything else follows. That algal overgrowth, diseases, death by a thousand cuts. That's what this is right here.
Study coordinator Gabriel Grimsditch says pinpointing the problems and then eliminating the causes could actually help corals to recover from bleaching and natural disturbances.
We're trying to give Ramon some data that he can point to tell people that the reef is being affected in this way. And there are certain actions that you can take to improve the resilience of the reef.
Ramon de Leon can't keep the water cool, but as park manager, he does have some sway over the threats that make the coral more vulnerable to overheating. We clamber into one of the park's well-worn pickup trucks and drive along the narrow island roads. This is actually a desert island, as in arid, dry. But people want it to look like the classic Caribbean paradise, so they plant coconut palms and other vegetation. Then they water, and the water rushes through the porous soils, sweeping nutrients with it.
This nutrient will end up sooner or later in the reef.
Nobody wants to hurt the reef, De Leon says. On the other hand, nobody really wants to hear from the park manager that they need to change their ways.
Sometimes you have to point finger and say, this is the problem, you are the cause, you have to solve it. Nobody like that, so we have to do it very, very careful. But all in all, I think people appreciate what we do for the coral reef here.
Since De Leon came to Bonaire 11 years ago from Uruguay, he's been telling people that if they care about the reef, they need to think differently about everything from coastal development and irrigation to fishing. And when he wants to show off just how healthy a reef can be, he takes people to one of the island's more remote and unpopulated dive spots. In fact, the science team heads to one of those pristine sites the next day. an island mockingbird calls down from a cactus as the divers gear up and Grimstitch makes a few last-minute adjustments to the science plan.
I mean, I think if we get four transects on a site, that's pretty good. But then it looks like the quadrats are taking a lot more time.
Once again, the divers disappear beneath the waves. But this time, when Mark Vermeij comes back, he looks happier.
So how healthy is this reef compared to the one you were diving at yesterday?
This? Orders of magnitudes better.
Vermeij says the reef here felt the impact of the same storm that caused so much damage down the coast last fall.
I mean, yeah, this place got hammered like hell, but it's growing back as hell, too.
Everything that should be working to help the reef recover is working here, he says.
Like corals that were fragmented, so the ones that were lying on the ground for a while, they're growing back. Lots of parrotfish, everybody happy. But yeah, it doesn't result in the postcard reef sort of thing. Resilience. The ability to come back after you got kicked very hard. This is the place where it actually works like.
The lesson here is clear. A reef that's healthy to begin with can rebound. So Vermeij says to help these rich and abundant ecosystems survive global warming, we need to reduce the stresses that are on them now. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The Earth is facing some very big problems: warmer oceans, rising carbon dioxide levels, new pollutants in the air and water, and it's going to take some very smart scientists to figure out what to do. But students in the U.S. aren't exactly flocking to programs that would prepare them to tackle these challenges. So NASA is taking to the skies in hopes of luring students into studying the planet. NPR's John Hamilton went along for a ride.
A great place to study the Earth is from the air.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, open.
These researchers are working in an airborne laboratory, a modified DC-8 flying low over the inland valleys of Central California.
Ready, close.
Every minute or so, one of them opens a valve that sends a sample of air from outside the plane into a stainless steel canister the size of an overgrown cocktail shaker.
Good. Now you can open up a little bit more to let the flow.
Oh, okay. I don't want it to drop. There.
Yeah.
The experiment will measure gases from dairy farms 1,000 feet below us. Cows belch up a lot of methane, and the process used to prepare their feed can raise levels of ozone, another greenhouse gas. Usually, flights like this are reserved for top researchers. But these two scientists are students. Camille Armayes-Noya is 29 and dressed in the flight's unofficial uniform, jeans and a T-shirt. She's been in pretty much constant motion since the seatbelt sign went off. When Camille's not checking the weather on a laptop, she's running the air sampler. It helps that she's thin enough to squeeze into the small gap between the equipment and a row of seats. Camille has a background in chemistry, and she's about to finish a master's in environmental management at the Metropolitan University in Puerto Rico.
Right now I am applying for a PhD in oceanography, and actually chemical oceanography. So I can, you know, apply what I study, but I also can experience new things, especially the ocean, which is my passion.
Daniel Tachik grew up in Georgia and has a buzz cut that falls somewhere between edgy and aerospace engineer. He's 23, but Daniel's resume already includes stuff like studying carbon in the salt marshes of Skidaway Island. This fall, Daniel will start a PhD in civil and environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. But he says he's been intrigued by the Earth's atmosphere since he was a kid.
You know, my family would be down in the basement during a tornado warning, and I'd be running up around upstairs trying to, you know, look out the window, try to see what I can see, and, you know, parents yelling at me.
Daniel and Camille are exactly the kind of people NASA hopes to attract to study our planet. They are highly motivated, they are fascinated by the Earth, and troubled by its environmental problems. Also, since high school, they've been taking all the right courses.
Calculus, Calculus II, linear algebra, differential equations, multivariable calculus, electromagnetics, Physics I.
Analytical chemistry, analytical chemistry 2, physical chemistry, organic.
High academic achievement helped them get on today's flight. The flight is part of NASA's Student Airborne Research Program, an experimental 6-week session designed to get young people excited about Earth science. The 29 students in this session have already heard lectures from people including Sherwood Rowland. He won the 1995 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for figuring out that CFCs were damaging the Earth's ozone layer. For the past few days, the students have been at NASA's Dryden Aircraft Operations Facility in Palmdale, California. Dr. George Seilstadt from the University of North Dakota worked with NASA to set up the program, including the in-flight experiments.
We're doing real science. This isn't a little practice lab session where you get to see how things would be done someday if you became a scientist. You're going to be a scientist, and we're going to come out with some real results. And the results all impact society.
In addition to gases from dairy farms, the students are looking at water consumption by cotton and almond plants. That's a big deal in Central California, where those crops have been hurt by years of drought. And the students are using an image sensor to study unusual algae growth in Monterey Bay. So-called algal blooms can kill fish and make shellfish poisonous. The blooms are more common in water contaminated by sewage and agricultural fertilizers.
So in every case, it's beautiful science, but this will help people if we come up with some solutions.
Seilstadt says those solutions are likely to come from a new generation of Earth scientists.
My generation has done the best science it could, and I think we've learned a lot about the Earth, but you're always looking for new ideas.
And new ideas, he says, often come from people who don't necessarily look like the older generation or sound like them.
Cinco, cuatro, tres, uno, abre.
A couple of hours into the flight, the students have collected most of the critical air samples, and the DC-8 is about to turn toward Monterey Bay for the algae experiment. There's been a lot of concern about a fog bank hovering over the bay. Fog makes it almost impossible to detect algae blooms. But at the moment, forecasters are predicting clear skies. The algae team, which includes Daniel and Camille, is pretty pumped up. Then, the pilot hears a couple of small clunks.
Did you hear the excitement?
And the students get some bad news.
We hit a small bird in engine number 2, and there's a little hole, but it's no emergency or anything. We're going to do the cotton field run one more time and basically head back. So we will not be flying over Monterey Bay, which means we have no data from this flight.
You can tell you're on a plane full of scientists when the biggest concern about a hole in the plane is whether it will screw up someone's experiment.
It sucks. Because the clouds, here, let's take a look at this little image right here. The clouds have finally opened up. Everything looks awesome. We would have had so much data, but now we got nothing. That is exactly the real world of science. Not everything works all the time, and, you know, you just gotta keep trying sometimes. I don't know.
By the time we're back on the ground, though, everyone is sounding a lot more optimistic.
Big round of applause for the flight crew and the support crew.
Next, the students will go back to the University of California, Irvine, to analyze their data.
Tomorrow morning, checkout is at 11 a.m. sharp, so...
The air sampling team will quantify the methanol and ethanol and ethane coming from dairy farms. This will help show the farm's contribution to global warming and perhaps whether the cows there should go on a low-emissions diet. Another group will figure out which parts of the cotton fields and almond orchards need more irrigation and which could do with a bit less. And Daniel and Camille will try to salvage their algae experiment using data from a flight 2 days earlier.
This group of techs are going to help us process the data. And then next week it starts the data analysis and all the hard work.
There are already hints that this hard work will pay off. A first look at the data suggests that an algae bloom is beginning to form in one corner of Monterey Bay. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Try to look into the future of American spaceflight, and you can only see 7 launches ahead. That's how many times NASA plans to use its aging space shuttles before retiring them. What comes next is not certain. It's almost time for some experts assembled by President Obama to finish their deliberations on what to do now, and we have a report this morning from NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce.
President Obama's independent blue ribbon panel on the future of human spaceflight held what was billed as its final public meeting in a big auditorium in Washington, D.C. The experts sat on a stage, and looming over them on a big screen was an image of a suited-up astronaut.
Today, our principal purpose is going to be to finalize the options that we presented when we last met.
Norman Augustine chairs the panel. He's a retired CEO of Lockheed Martin.
At the end of today, it's our hope that we'll have a general good agreement on the options that we would lay before the decision makers.
Some decisions definitely need to be made. NASA's current plan would retire the space shuttle next year. Astronauts could then ride Russian rockets to the space station. But right now, there's no money in the budget to support the space station past 2015. What's more, NASA is supposed to be building new space vehicles to return to the moon by 2020. But the expected money for this program has been cut over the years. And now, this panel says that moon goal just isn't feasible if NASA's budget continues at its current level of about $18 billion a year. Former astronaut Sally Ride put up a bunch of charts showing the numbers.
The current budget guidance is very, very, very limiting.
Even if NASA wanted to take space exploration in a different direction, this budget would limit what it could do.
So far, we haven't found a scenario that includes exploration that's viable.
She and the rest of the panel did discuss options that NASA could pursue if it got more money, things like extending the life of the space station or sending astronauts not to the moon, but out into deep space to fly by things like asteroids. Some options were eliminated. For example, the committee generally agreed that Mars was the ultimate goal, but trying to go there directly would be too technically challenging and expensive.
I really want to emphasize we're not giving up on Mars at all. We're just saying that we think to go direct to Mars with today's technology and money is riskier than we would want to be associated with.
After the meeting, Augustine said he felt they'd made progress in evaluating possible ways forward and the financial reality.
I think it would be fair to say that our view is that it will be difficult with the current budget to do anything that's terribly inspiring in the human spaceflight area.
On the other hand, he says, even with a limited budget, NASA could prepare for future spaceflight achievements.
It's just they won't come as soon.
He says they're working to finish up their report by the end of the month. But on Friday, they'll brief White House officials on their findings so far. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.